91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we hear how WLRN-TV's new blockbuster documentary, Treblinka's Last Witness, came about. Good afternoon. It's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. The Treblinka extermination site operated for 13 months at the height of World War II. Some 900,000 Jews were slaughtered there. Nazi Germany's methods were efficient and gruesome. Treblinka's Last Witness premieres tomorrow night on WLRN-TV Channel 17. It features the last known survivor of the camp, 92-year-old Samuel Willenberg. He's been haunted by his memories of Treblinka for 70 years. The Treblinka documentary project was conceived by WLRN General Manager John Labonia and produced and directed by filmmaker Alan Tomlinson. More about Treblinka's Last Witness after the news.
And we return. It's Topical Currents Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. This hour, we discuss a stirring new WLRN-TV documentary. It's Treblinka's Last Witness, and premieres tomorrow night at 9 on Channel 17. Check your cable or satellite listings. Treblinka's Last Witness chronicles the notorious Nazi extermination facility, Treblinka, which was active for a 13-month period during World War II. The Last Witness title refers to 92-year-old Samuel Willenberg, thought to be the last living survivor of the camp. He's a major figure in the production. Joining us now is WLRN-TV producer and journalist Alan Tomlinson. He's a filmmaker who's the creative force behind the program. Welcome to you, Alan Tomlinson. I know you've worked a long time on this.
Yes, this has been a film that has had a long gestation process. We began talking about it at WLRN about 4 years ago, and it took a while. You know, when you approach the Holocaust as a topic, especially in a community like this one, where we're surrounded by so many Holocaust survivors in South Florida and the children of Holocaust survivors, it's not something you enter into lightly. So it took us a long time to figure out how we were going to approach this.
Well, we'll look forward to getting into more details on that.
Okay, also with us is historian, author, and educator Michael Barenbaum. His expertise is a big part of Last Witness, and he joins us from Beverly Hills. Welcome to you, Michael Barenbaum.
Thank you.
Also in studio with us is WLRN General Manager John Labonia. He's the force who inspired and shepherded the production after a visit to the Florida Holocaust Museum. Welcome. Always good to see you, John.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Bonnie.
Good to have you. I just want to say first that the premieres tomorrow night at 8 on WLRN TV, Channel 17.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I said corrected.
That's okay. And I want to congratulate all of you on an excellent, moving, and emotionally powerful film. It's, I think, a significant addition to the existing body of Holocaust films.
Thank you.
John, let's begin with you. As Joe mentioned, you were inspired by a visit to the Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg. Why your interest in the Holocaust and Treblinka in particular?
Well, I've always been a big fan of history. And I was attending a meeting in St. Petersburg and had some time off in the afternoon. And I was just walking around, and a few blocks from the hotel was the Florida Holocaust Museum. So I decided to go in and look around. I went in. First thing I saw was this rail car, and I didn't think that much of it. So I toured around the rest of the museum. And when I was done, I was just heading out the door, and a volunteer that was sitting by this rail car comes up to me and says, you know, when we were dusting out the rail car this week, we do this every couple of weeks, we found a gold ring that apparently belonged to a child. And we found it in between two of the floorboards. And I just could not get that image out of my mind. So I didn't know that much about Treblinka. Obviously, you know, I know about the Holocaust, but the next thing I did was I got a couple of books and started reading about this place. And the more I read, the more consuming it became for me, because I have never read about a place like this. I've read about Auschwitz and some of the other camps, but not these death camps. These death camps were, to me, ground zero of the Holocaust. And that image of that ring and this child, I could not get it out of my mind. And so I said, you know, this is the story of this place needs to be told, but it needs to be told in a way that's not too heavy in terms of traditional documentary work. And so I began to assemble what I thought was the best production team that we could afford. And that included Alan Tomlinson, Michael Berenbaum, Miriam Klein, Kassenhoff, and Adrian Kennedy. And when I approached Alan about this project, he says, "You want to do what? You want to do a film about a place that doesn't exist anymore? There are probably no photographs or film of this place, and there's probably nobody left alive." And I said, "That's the story I want to tell." So Alan did his thing and began to assemble information. And you got to remember, when you do projects like this, and this is probably one of the most, for me, it's definitely one of the most difficult projects I've ever worked on, because when you're dealing with history, everything has to be right. You cannot make a mistake. And so that's why we brought in Dr. Michael Berenbaum, who is one of the world's most renowned Holocaust historians. Through these past 4 years, Michael has become not only a trusted colleague, but a very good friend of mine. And it was with Michael's guiding expertise of the Holocaust that I think really made this film what it is, because he supplied all the historical accuracy that we needed.
Let's turn to Dr. Michael Berenbaum. Doctor, could you reflect on the historical significance of the last witness, Samuel Willenberg?
Well, let me begin with a word. First of all, thanks to John for an overly kind statement. He's a cherished friend and an admired colleague. Let me begin, though, with a word about Treblinka. You know, Mark Twain once said there are truth, lies, and statistics, so let me give you a couple of statistics. Treblinka was opened on July 22, 1942. It essentially completed its last killing on August 2, 1943. In those 10 months and a little bit less, in those 12 months and a little bit less than 2 weeks, close to 900,000 Jews were killed. And there were 67 survivors of Treblinka who were participants in the great uprising and the escape, who survived post-war. Samuel Willenberg is literally the last one. He's the last person who will give us access into the inner chambers of that hell. And consequently, his voice becomes ever more important. To top it off, Samuel Willenberg was an eyewitness to it all, and he's a phenomenal storyteller. So Alan will tell you that our most difficult task was to turn on the camera and get out of the way and let Sam tell his story. He's that compelling, he's that powerful, he's that important. And after him, it will only be historical memory and not living memory. So his words gain an added poignancy at this moment in time.
And Alan Tomlinson, let's bring you into this. You say you were, or John said you were reluctant to make the film at first. Tell us why and why you decided to make it.
Well, for a number of reasons. One of those being that, you know, I'm not Jewish myself, so this is terrain that you enter into with an extra responsibility as any filmmaker, but this particular one, you know, there's sort of an ethos out there that this is something that maybe only Jewish historians and Jewish filmmakers, only terrain that they should enter into. So I had a little trepidation on that front. Secondly, I felt, you know, the Holocaust has been done. There are a lot of films, a lot written and filmed about the Holocaust. Growing up in post-war Britain, you know, we were very familiar with all aspects of the Second World War through my childhood and early teens, including the Holocaust. So I wasn't sure what we could bring to the table that people were not already familiar with. And, you know, finally, as John said, how do you make a film about something which was so completely eradicated, including the victims, that there is nothing left to see? Unlike Auschwitz, where you can visit the place and the buildings are still there, the ovens are still there. Many survivors, because it was a work camp, a concentration camp, not a death camp.
Not only a death camp.
No. But Treblinka, you know, and all these similar camps were only there for one purpose, and that was the industrialized killing of large numbers of Jews. So it really wasn't until we found Samuel Wilmberg that I completely changed my mind and discovered that his story was so completely compelling, so completely unlike any other story that anybody has ever told me in a long career in journalism and filmmaking, that I felt, just as John had, compelled to tell the story.
How did you find Samuel Wilmberg?
Well, it wasn't terribly difficult. You know, we've been led to believe that there was nobody left. You know, I traced him. I'm a journalist by training. So, you know, I sort of tracked his story down from an old interview he'd done years ago with the BBC and assumed that this, you know, he'd died since. But just to make sure, I pulled up the Tel Aviv phone book online and found that there were about a dozen Samuel Wilmbergs there. Began calling them, and, you know, he and his wife, Ada, responded on the telephone. And when we realized that we had a 90-year-old survivor, I mean, I was literally on the next plane because the expectation that he'd be around much longer, of course, was small.
We're speaking about the new WLRN documentary, Treblinka's Last Witness. It premieres tomorrow night at 8 on WLRN Channel 17. We're speaking with, you heard the voice of Alan Tomlinson. He's director of programming and production at WLRN and an award-winning journalist and television producer. John Libonia is the general manager of WLRN Public Radio and Television, and Michael Barenbaum is a world-renowned historian, author, lecturer, and teacher. And we will be right back.
I matki w wagonach podnosiły dzieci, żeby zobaczyć pierwszy raz w życiu sosnę. Bo w gettach nie było. W gettach nie było nic.
And we're back with today's topical currents. We're hearing the voice of Samuel Wilmberg. Alan Tomlinson, tell us what he's saying.
Samuel took me to Treblinka. There's still a site there marked by about 17,000 stones that commemorate the number of Jewish communities that were represented in the 900,000 people who died there. And as he took me there, you know, he answered the troubling question of why Jews went to their death in such large numbers. He was on a transport of about 5,000 to 6,000 people from the village where he was rounded up by the Nazis. Why there was no immediate resistance? And there are many answers to that question. And I mean, first one has to say that in some cases there was resistance. But in most cases, you know, the Nazis went out of their way to convince the people who got on those rail transports that they weren't going to their deaths. I mean, how could you imagine that 5,000 or 6,000 people were going to be killed all in one fell swoop? And to the extent that when they got to Treblinka, which is in the middle of a pine forest, midway between Warsaw and Bialystok, which were two of the main poles of Polish Jewry, two of the main centers of Polish Jewry, he described to me how women in the boxcars were holding up their children. This is what he's describing in the clip you just played, holding up their children to the the open windows of the barbed wire covered windows of the boxcars to show them greenery, pine trees, because they'd been confined in ghettos for so long where there was no greenery, and that the children were excited about this. And the mothers were telling them, oh, look, you know, we're going somewhere nice, because nobody on that transport had any idea what was in store for them. They all thought they were being transported further east to work colonies, and that there was a future beyond that terrible trip in the boxcars. So there was deception at every level, and Samuel describes it in this moment in the film.
Michael Barenbaum, tell us what's known about the construction of Treblinka, and why was that site chosen by the Germans?
Essentially, you have to understand what happened in the killing beforehand. The Germans implemented what they called the final solution to the Jewish problem, beginning essentially on June 22, 1941. Their first killing was in former Soviet-held territories, and they sent mobile killers to stationary victims. They killed them one by one by one, village by village, hamlet by hamlet, bullet by bullet, person by person. They found this was problematic. Now, problematic in their terms is not morally problematic, but problematic in the sense that it was public, people were seeing it, problematic in the sense that it was difficult for the killers to sustain themselves day in, day out, killing every day. Some broke down, some had nightmares, some really just couldn't take it. And they also couldn't kill in the numbers they needed to kill to eliminate the entire Jewish population of Poland. After all, there were 3.3 million Jews in the territories of Poland that they had captured. They therefore reversed what they were doing, which is instead of sending mobile killers to stationary victims, they made the victims mobile, which was the railroad car, deportation, and all the associated elements of that. They made the victims mobile, and they instituted what we call stationary killing centers, which are factory whose end product is death. Now, Treblinka was chosen for a very simple reason. It was situated in German-occupied Poland, and situated there essentially for reasons of convenience. If Willie Sutton said, essentially, why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. Why do you put this killing center in German-occupied Poland? That's because that's where the Jews were. And they chose sites that were easily accessible by railroad line. And as Alan said, this was on the railroad line between Warsaw and Bialystok, two great centers of Jewish life. And indeed, the camp opened on July 22, 1942, and within the next days, between the 23rd of July and the 21st of September, essentially in 2 months, more than 265,000 Jews were killed at Treblinka from Warsaw alone.
Michael, would you describe the transports to Treblinka, just to go back to that?
Transports to Treblinka were essentially, the Jews were rounded up. They were told that they were going to work camps. They were offered marmalade and bread, which don't sound like much to us, but they were essentially luxury and desperately needed in the ghettos themselves. They were put onto cattle cars. The cattle cars had no provisions for water, no provisions for food. A bucket was provided for sanitary situation. And they were held on these trains for a long period of time. Sometimes a trip that should take hours took days. Sometimes in certain cases from, for example, Greece and the like, it took 9 days. And the longer they stayed on the trains, the more depressed and frightened they became. And then when they arrived in Auschwitz, when they arrived in Treblinka, they thought they had survived the worst. And they got out. They all of a sudden were overwhelmed by the sights of air and by the sheer beauty of the place. And then they had no selection there. They were essentially sent immediately to their death. Those who were weak and could not walk, were sent to a special quotation marks hospital, where they were immediately killed, and they were killed by placing them directly into the flames, bypassing the entire process of gassing. And within hours of arrival, 99 and 44 100% of the population who arrived were dead. The difference between Sam and the others was essentially Sam had gotten word from somebody who recognized him to say that he was a builder and that he had skills that were necessary for the maintenance of the camp. And consequently, they went, separated him out, and they offered him the opportunity to become, they imposed upon him the opportunity to become one of the people who worked in the camps, with the idea that death would be delayed, and essentially, he'd be useful for them.
Well, we have a description of Sam when he arrived there before he knew. No, he already knew that he was going to be saved when the man told him to become a builder. But he's describing one of the things that happens when the people got there.
I nagle podeszli chłopcy z czerwonymi packami na rękach i rozdawali sznurki nam. Każdym dostał sznurek i nie wiedzieliśmy po co.
Alan, what is Samuel describing?
Samuel's describing the moment when they hit the platform at Treblinka, and he describes, and he has a sculpture, which one of 15 sculptures that he's created, which enshrine this image in his mind of a father bending down to take off the shoes of his small son. The Germans were terribly efficient, and they immediately had the victims take off their shoes and tie the shoes together. They tied them together because that meant they didn't have to make pairs to send back to Germany, where all this booty from the extermination camp was recycled into the German war effort. As Samuel was bending down to untie his own shoes, somebody he knew from his past recognized him and tipped him off to say he was a builder because they needed a few Jewish workers at the camp. This was a guy called Alfred Böhm, who he'd helped as a teenager. He'd been deported from Germany to Poland as a teenager and was constantly getting beaten up by the young Polish boys on Samuel's street. He lived in a mixed neighborhood of Poles and Jews. And Samuel, who was a strapping young lad, saved him from the beatings. And here, years later, by the most outlandish chance, Alfred Böhm is on the platform as one of the working Jews, recognizes Samuel. Samuel didn't recognize him, separates him. And Samuel describes how he was moved into a barracks as being the builder. He wasn't a builder. He was just told to say he was and did. And he was the only one there. And Samuel then realized, Alfred came back later to tell him that he was the only one on that transport of 5,000 to 6,000 people from the town where he was rounded up who survived that day. Everybody else had been killed in the last 2 hours.
Was there mention of the extraction of gold teeth and women's hair and how long was the average length of time that the prisoner before they actually were killed?
No time at all. Literally, they
same day.
Within hours. Trains were unloaded in the morning, and within 2 or 3 hours of them hitting the platform, in most cases, everybody on those transports was dead.
Michael, how many Jews were killed every 24 hours?
Well, Treblinka could essentially process three or four trains a day. There was a backup for Treblinka. So thousands, I would think it's safe to say 3,000 to 5,000 a day. Remember, if you're looking, let's do it backwards. 265,000 were killed in 60 days. So that's 4,000 essentially a day, 4,500 people a day. That was when it was just beginning, so they only got more effective and more efficient as time went on.
We need to take another break. We're speaking about a new WLRN documentary, Treblinka's Last Witness. It premieres tomorrow night at 8 on WLRN Channel 17. That was the voice of Dr. Michael Berenbaum, a world-renowned historian. Also with us, John Libonia, who we haven't let talk in a while. He's the general manager of WLRN TV and radio. And Alan Tomlinson is an award-winning journalist and television producer who directed, wrote, produced, directed, edited, and did camera work on this film. Stay with us.
It was very, very swift. The whole thing took less than 2 hours.
I zrozumiałem potem, to Alfred powiedział, oni wszyscy poszli do gal. Nie wierzyłem. Nie mogłem uwierzyć. 6 tysięcy ludzi poszło do gadu w przeciągu paru godzin. I tak patrzałem. I ja się zostałem jeden z tych 6 tysięcy. Jeden. To był dla mnie szok. Szok. Nie wiem, ale instynkt jakiś miałem. Instynkt. Ja nie wierzyłem. Nie mogłem uwierzyć, że coś takiego na oczach na moich jest, że tu mordują 6 tysięcy w przeciągu paru godzin. To było coś najgorszego, co mogłem przeżyć.
Samuel's telling us here about the moment he realized where he was. He'd been rescued by his old friend, and he came back sometime later to tell him that, to ask him, Samuel, do you have any idea where you are? He had no idea where he was. He thought he was in some kind of transit camp heading to work. And he said, you're in a death camp, Samuel. There is only death here. Everybody but you on that transport is already dead. And Samuel's response, as you can hear, you know, Samuel doesn't speak any English. There's a lot of Polish in this. But I guarantee you, if you watch this film, you will find this man's story mesmerizing. It's subtitled, but we decided to subtitle it so you could actually see this man telling the story, because he tells it with such passion mm-hmm. that you really, you, throughout the film, you're kind of there with him. And this awful moment where he says, I couldn't believe it. How could you imagine that 5,000 or 6,000 people could be killed in just a few hours, and I'm the only one left? Yedin, he says, just me. He said he was in shock. He was absolutely shocked. He couldn't believe it, and it took him hours. He says days, really, to realize where he was. That he was in hell.
John Libonia, last week there was a big premiere of Last Witness at the historic Olympia Theater in downtown Miami. After all the years of this production, how did that sit with you since you inspired it?
I think it was one of the greatest events that we've ever had. I mean, it was absolutely jaw-dropping to experience this film in the Olympia Theater with a packed house. I believe that what we set out to do and the impact that we meant to have with this film, I think that last Tuesday evening showed us in person the impact that this film is going to have. And when viewers tune in tomorrow evening to watch this, I believe that they are going to experience the same impact that we experienced in a theater last week.
John, did making this, inspiring it, the making of it, has it changed you in any way?
It just strengthens in me that WLRN on the television side has truly found what its real mission is, and that mission is to be South Florida's storyteller. This just cements that in for me, in my mind, that we are on the right track in producing all the wonderful stories that we produce. And even though this isn't necessarily a South Florida story, it started in Florida, and it's a film for everybody. It's a film that is not only going to be distributed in the United States, but will be distributed worldwide.
Yeah, I wondered about that, what you were going to do, distribution. How are you doing that?
Alan and Adrian and I are, Adrian Kennedy, who's one of the executive producers on the program, are exploring what our options are. We know that what we want to achieve is the greatest distribution that we can, that people from all around the world should have an opportunity to see this film. And I think we're going to be able to make that happen. I think it's such a powerful film. I think that Alan's producing skills are absolutely magnificent. When I would bring rough cuts of this film home, like I do all of our films, I would sit there and I watch this thing, and you become so emotional watching this. And so I had a conversation with Alan this morning. I said, I couldn't imagine seeing this for the first time in its completed form. And when we were in that theater last week, there was no coughing, there was no talking. People were absolutely stuck to that screen.
In fact, you know, we've had a tremendous response from people who were at last Tuesday's theatrical premiere, many of whom are prominent members of the South Florida Jewish community, some of whom were Holocaust survivors or the children of Holocaust survivors. And one gentleman wrote to us to say that he's seen a lot of Holocaust films and has never, ever been able to get through one, because at some point in most Holocaust films, the horror of what you're seeing is so awful that you have to avert your eyes. And he said he's never, ever gotten through one. But he got through this one, in part because Samuel's storytelling is so powerful. Mm-hmm. He's the most amazing storyteller I've ever met, you know. And as Michael Barenboim mentioned earlier, you know, all we had to do really was get out of his way and let him tell his story. But also, we tried very hard, and I think we succeeded. In the horror is there, but it's downplayed. What you get from Samuel and his story, and I hope the experience you have with this film, is what it felt like to experience the Holocaust, the emotions that one experiences. Samuel's very unlike many Holocaust survivors who speak about these events.
Many of them won't speak about it.
And if they do, they speak at a certain understandable emotional distance from it.
Right.
Samuel's not like that. He has embraced it. He told us that he feels. I asked him once, you know, how do you think you escaped Treblinka when
exactly.
so many didn't? And he said, you know, Alan, when you think about it, I didn't really escape Treblinka. I'm still in Treblinka. I think about it every day. It never leaves me. Treblinka goes with me wherever I go. And truly, he's carrying this around with him and feels the need to tell the story. So when Samuel tells the story, the gloves are off. The man is a cocktail of conflicting emotions. He's mesmerizing. He goes from stories that are the cynicism of the Nazis that he tells with a certain cynical humor to outbursts of anger, to tears when we learn that his own two sisters died right there in Treblinka.
While and he found one of their dresses.
He found their clothing. He was on duty that day to pick up the clothing of the victims and recognized the clothing of two of his sisters.
And it's something he couldn't tell. It's something he couldn't tell to his own mother.
Right.
Never could.
Never did. And one of the most powerful moments is he said, I couldn't cry then. And then you see him in tears. And you understand how immediate this is for him.
Michael Barenboim, could you describe the uprising at Treblinka, which is what allowed Samuel Willenberg to survive the death camp?
There was a couple of very interesting paradoxical compromises of all the people who were in Treblinka. The people who stayed in Treblinka were kept alive not because the Nazis wanted them alive, but because they were necessary for the enterprise. So as long as people kept coming in large numbers, they were indispensable. The moment, quotation marks, the killing slowed down, that's the moment of greatest vulnerability for the remaining workers. They agreed that what they would do was to start amassing weapons and also amassing money, both money and whatever gold and silver, by stealing it from the warehouses where they were dealing with it all the time. And that eventually they would have an uprising in which they would storm the gates and hopefully everybody would get out. The uprising began a little bit earlier than they expected it to because somebody lost their nerve and started it. And consequently, they they killed some of the guards. They stormed the gates. They tried to get out, but they weren't able to get out. Many of them were not able to get out, and some who were able to get out were subsequently caught. And they set part of the camp, but not all of the camp, on fire. And this was regarded as a tremendously powerful to them emotionally, because they had rid themselves and, as it were, freed themselves from the Nazis' grasp, albeit for a moment. Over the next period of time, many of these people were captured and caught. And the most interesting thing for Samuel's own experience was that he found the safest place that he could remain was to go back to the ghetto, which itself was vulnerable.
Alan, you wanted to add something?
Yes, I think, you know, in approaching the Holocaust, I think there's one thing that struck me is that we needed to deal with one of the most awful canards of the Second World War, and that's the myth that the Jews didn't fight. Samuel fought as a soldier and was seriously wounded as a soldier in the Polish army resisting the Nazis when they marched into Poland. He fought to get out of Treblinka. And then when he got back to the Warsaw ghetto, he fought during the Warsaw uprising. He's a national hero in Poland. And Samuel's story, like the story of many Jews who survived, was one of fighting for his life.
Michael, did you want to add something else?
Well, I think that I want to touch on something that Alan said. You know, for some, liberation meant that they could put their past behind them, and they didn't want to go back. They didn't want to touch this experience. For others, liberation meant that they had a responsibility to become a witness. And for Samuel, the acute sense of being a witness and now being the last witness is what fully drives him and what propels him. And we were interested in his family's response. His family had a very interesting response. Samuel's 92, 93, they were worried what this would do in terms of his life. And his daughter came back with the feeling not only did it not shorten his life, but it increased his life, because there's a sense in which this is the purpose for which he lives, and it's days like this that give his continued existence some ultimate meaning and significance.
You know, in the opening scene of the movie, I mean, you could almost, it was just so touching. I want, Alan, for you to tell us about his sculptures. And, I mean, we can talk, we have the clip of Orit talking about them. Maybe we should do that. Paul, number 10.
He did this series of sculptures which really burst out from him. He couldn't stop. He was working day and night, you know. He was eating with the sculptures, sleeping with the sculptures, until the whole series came out of him.
I potem zacząłem rzeźbić następne sztyty. Zacząłem przypominać sobie coraz bardziej, coraz brnie.
Samuel is telling us here how when he retired, he didn't know what to do with himself, and he took up sculpture. And when we were out there interviewing him, not only were we struck by the power of his storytelling ability, but he took us down to the basement of his apartment building in Tel Aviv. And there we found that there were 14 of 15 sculptures, beautiful bronze sculptures that he'd made that visualize his nightmares, visualize some of the most horrific scenes that he cannot drive from his mind. And we employ in the film some of these sculptures as storytelling vehicles. They're astonishing sculptures. They're very beautiful. With each one is an incredible story.
Why do you think they're not in a museum?
He's had a couple of offers to split them up and have them included in exhibitions of Holocaust art. There is Holocaust art and quite a lot of it. But he doesn't want to split them up because he sees these as his story, Treblinka's story. And his last wish, his dream, is to create an education center, a museum at the Treblinka site, where at the moment there is not one, where he hopes that these sculptures can reside. In fact, his daughter, who is an architect, has designed a museum, and they're currently trying to raise enough money to fund a museum where these sculptures can reside in perpetuity.
In Israel?
No. The museum, the place these sculptures really belong is back in Treblinka.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being because the sculptures are his depiction of what happened in Treblinka. And when you say not in a museum, I always want to say not yet in a museum. And part of the reason for that is that Treblinka itself, and we show it magnificently in the film, Treblinka itself is an awesomely powerful memorial. But unless you know what you're memorializing, you don't learn of the experience of Treblinka in Treblinka. And what really has to happen there is the visitor has to get an opportunity to learn what happened in Treblinka And Samuel would be an absolutely fitting guide to this experience because, first of all, his sculptures themselves are powerful and evocative. They do tell a story. And secondly, because of his unique status now as the very last survivor.
I'd like to listen to when you were interviewing him, you said the last question you asked him was if he believed in God. Paul, would you do number 9?
Dla mnie był Bóg przed wojną, ale po Treblince on przestał istnieć. Nie ma nic, że tak to było, bo Bóg, gdzie on był? Gdzie on był, jak mordowali ludzi? Jak dzieci mordowali? Gdzie on był? Jak mógłby być? Za co? Za co moja siostrzyczka zostaje zabita za druga siostrzyczka? To gdzie ten Bóg był?
What did he say?
What Samuel's saying here, and I think you can hear the passion that comes through when he's speaking about this, is that, yes, he did believe in God before the war, before Treblinka. But having experienced the amount of mass killing that he witnessed in Treblinka, having witnessed the death of his two beloved sisters in Treblinka, he no longer believes. He doesn't find it in him to believe. It was literally the last question I asked him after many, many days of interviews to draw this story out of him. In fact, his wife, Ada, who's also featured in the film, she has an interesting parallel story to tell. She's a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto. Kind of wrapped up the interview with this because this was kind of the last outpouring that he felt that how could there be a God who would allow such a horror to take place.
What was difficult, besides the emotion, of making this production, even from a technical standpoint?
It wasn't
the linguistic and the translation.
The linguistic issue. We interviewed Samuel twice. We did the interviews. Michael and I did it in Hebrew, but then subsequently we decided that Samuel was so much more eloquent in his native Polish that we did the whole thing again in his native Polish. And he's such a passionate speaker that you don't want to interrupt the interview with a lot of questions. So we just got out of his way and let him tell the story. It was obvious that this was an amazing story. I often joke with people when they say, "How did you draw this story out of Samuel?" And I often say, I only asked him one question.
Yeah, right.
The rest, he handed it to us on a plate, a gift from one of the most eloquent men that I've ever met.
I wonder if a few years ago he ever imagined he would be in Miami and have this tremendous documentary be premiered in his presence.
He'd never thought. It's actually very rewarding. Samuel is my severest critic, is our severest critic, and he likes the movie. And if he hadn't endorsed it with his blessing, I don't know what I would have felt about it. It was a tremendous responsibility to tell it. But when we asked him if he'd be willing at the age of 92 to fly to Miami, he said absolutely. And when he left, he said he was really delighted that he'd come. He got an amazing welcome here.
Alan, I'm wondering how you felt about the Holocaust before making this film, and how you feel about it now, how it's changed your view of it, your thoughts, your feelings.
Well, you know, one often feels that there's nothing left to learn. And it's taught me, as journalism and filmmaking so often does teach all of us, that we still have so much to learn. There's always something to learn. And I think those who watch this tomorrow night, I think they'll be surprised at how much they didn't know about the Holocaust. I thought I knew a lot, but listening to Samuel, I realized that there was so much I didn't know, and probably still a lot. And as long as we have these survivors to tell us these stories, they're stories that need to be told. And I think we have one here that does justice to Samuel's story. He certainly thinks so, and that's the single most rewarding element of praise that we've had for this film. It's Samuel thinks it's his story well told.
Wow.
And it is.
Go ahead.
I mean, it really is, in the double sense of the term. Number one, it's his story. And it's well told, in part because, Alan had a modesty in dealing with it, and the modesty was to recognize that he had to open the door and allow Samuel to give voice to his experience, and that if he did that, he'd have the film, and then he only enhanced our understanding of it.
And we have a clip of Samuel talking about his life today, and actually it was prompted by something that you asked him, Alan. But, Paul, if you'd play number 11.
Największą zemstą moją jest, że stworzyłem rodzinę piękną, kochaną. Amen.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. My żyjemy. My dalej
żyjemy. This scene was filmed at a Sabbath supper at the family home outside Tel Aviv. And Samuel said to me that the best revenge is to have a good life. And he has had a good life. He married Ada, another Holocaust survivor. They moved to Israel in 1950. He had an amazing career for 40 years as senior surveyor with the Israeli Development Ministry. And I mean, he watched the State of Israel grow while he was there. He has a marvelous daughter, Orit, who's a successful architect, and three beautiful grandchildren. Orit was actually asked to be the architect for the Israeli embassy in Berlin when the Germans unified and they moved the embassies from Bonn to Berlin. We went to Berlin with them to see this. So at the end, Samuel's story is a story of triumph. And he says, you know, we've had a good life. We're not sad. We carry this with us, but we've had a happy life.
And actually, upon meeting him, how would you just describe him? I mean, he's just a passionate man.
Samuel's a force of nature. Samuel is a when you meet Samuel, you can see how he survived. He's a tough man to kill. He has the light of life burning in him constantly, and you can see that in the film through everything he says. And you can't take your eyes off him when he's speaking. He's a life force, and that's why he's still alive today. The Last Witness of Treblinka.
We just have a few seconds. John, you want to say anything before we go? I mean,
I just, you know, want to take an opportunity to, you know, thank Alan, Michael, and Adrian for bringing my idea to the screen. I watched these folks work for 4 years, and there were many ups and downs with this project, but they stayed with it. They knew where they wanted to end up with it, and I am extremely pleased, and you will be too when you view this.
Well, again, Treblinka's Last Witness premieres tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on WLRN Channel 17. That was the voice of John Libonia. He's the general manager of WLRN Public Radio and Television. Alan Tomlinson, director of programming and production. He wrote, directed, produced, edited the film. And Dr. Michael Barenbaum is a world-renowned historian, author, lecturer, and teacher. Thank you so much.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. If you didn't catch the entire program or want someone else to hear it, we have free audio downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, more information, links, photos, and discussion on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow we look at some fascinating South Florida history with Johns Hopkins University history professor Nathan Connolly. This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening. Thanks for making public radio your companion today.